Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our featured guest today is Francis Spufford, talking about his new novel, Light Perpetual. We'll also hear from Geetha Lodge on her new psychological thriller, Lie Beside Me. And Dave Lawrence and Stephen Brotherston will be chatting about Scarred for Life, TV in the 1980s. There's something for everyone on this show. But first of all, Francis, welcome to Bookmark.
Thank you for having me.
Lovely to have you with us again. And I said local slant there in the beginning, and I was pleased to see, delighted in fact, seeing the acknowledgements to your novel, the mention of a Cambridge coffee shop.
I was a promiscuous coffee shop user back in the day when you could be, and half the book was written in a coffee shop in Ely and the other half was written in Free Plug, Hot Numbers of Gwydir Street, which I hope and trust will be emerging when the pandemic floodwaters go down. I really hope that they will still be there alive and well and ready to serve me my next flat white.
Oh, yes, definitely. Well, how are you coping now then, writing-wise, without coffee shops to go to?
I've had to get used to the strenuous task of writing at home. It didn't help. In fact, Light Perpetual, this book I've got out now, I finished literally days before lockdown. So I didn't have a project to keep me going. I kind of cast around like a beetle with his back on the ground and his legs in the air or something.
Well, you do have a connection to Cambridge as well, don't you? Beside the coffee shop, you studied here, you met your wife here.
My adult life has been divided more or less half and half between things to do with London, always South London, which is why the novel is a South London novel, and things to do with Cambridge. I've orbited Cambridge. When I haven't lived in it, I've lived around it, south of Cambridge, north of Cambridge, and now I'm in Ely. Cambridge is a magnet, and I am a little iron filing flying round and round it.
So is this where it's home now?
Yeah, I was born in Cambridge for that, but I was born in what used to be Mill Road Maternity Hospital, about 100 yards from my latest cafe. So you could say I have made no progress at all escaping from Cambridge.
Who would say such a thing? We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But I'm imagining, because your wife is a canon of Ely Cathedral, that music, because we're going to hear your first choice of music in just a moment, that music is pretty central to your life, choral music, hymns, that kind of thing.
It is, but I'm still a musical ignoramus. I'm the unmusical member of a very musical extended family. So I love music, but I can't actually produce any of it. It's always a bit vampiric having a writer in the family anyway, because they steal the things that happen to you and they steal the things you know about. And I have busily stolen my extended family's knowledge of music for this. I couldn't have written it without copious use of other people's brains and other people's musical tastes.
Glorious first choice of music that you've got here, Mockingbird by Dusty Springfield. Always great to play Dusty Springfield. Why this one?
Because the book is a kind of musical history of London from its sort of post-war beginning. It's lots of other things too, but it's that. And my character, Joe, who is a session musician and nearly rock star in the novel, performs Mockingbird in a Soho club in 1964. And it's a lovely song. And also Dusty Springfield is a great figure for female musicianship in England at a time when there wasn't a lot of that about. And my fictional Joe is also thwarted and stymied by being a woman. So this is in honour of her.
That was Mockingbird by Dusty Springfield, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our featured guest, Francis Spufford. Francis's debut novel, Golden Hill, won, well, what didn't it win? The Costa First Novel Award, the RSL Ondaatje Prize and the Desmond Elliott Prize, as well as being shortlisted for many, many more. His new novel, Light Perpetual, published earlier this year, follows the lives of five people from South London through the 1960s, the Thatcherite 80s, up to 2009. Or rather, it follows the lives they might have lived had they not been killed as children by a German rocket strike in November 1944. The Daily Telegraph called it powerful, heartbreaking, a boundlessly rich novel. And the Financial Times said of it, Light Perpetual's brilliance lies in the emotion and drama it wrings from the ordinary but profoundly meaningful experiences of its protagonists. I could go on with the rave reviews, Frances. I absolutely loved this book. And I must say, I'm feeling quite smug seeing you again, because I think the first time I saw you was very shortly after Golden Hill had come out. And I did say to you, clear your mantelpiece, you're going to win some awards. And of course, as we've heard, you did. I mean, how wonderful for your first novel to get such a response.
It was astonishing. You were, as it turned out, absolutely right. I mean, I'm not expecting that ever to happen again. That was the lightning strike when suddenly I was taken by surprise and electrified. But I'm hoping people enjoy this one because it's rather different. The previous one, Golden Hill, was a very plotted novel, and it was a kind of historical romance in some ways. Not that it was all love story, but it had one of those in, and about umpteen different other things too. It was about good-looking, young, exceptional people and large sums of money in a setting that was kind of a special effect in itself. And the whole action took about 6 weeks and the characters ran through it. Whereas this is a much more life-shaped, less plotted, on the face of it, but more a book about ordinariness, though I'm not convinced there is such a thing as an ordinary life if you look at it close up. It's about what it's like being a human being, living in time and specifically in the second half of the 20th century, which was a point where five working class kids from South London suddenly had destinies open up to them that hadn't been available to their ancestors, and also suddenly had the city around them change in short order and then change and change again. And it seemed like a very rich subject and a good chance to go, actually, in times like that, being a Fleet Street printer whose skill's going to disappear or being a bus conductor is interesting enough in itself. You don't really need a tightly wound plot or, you know, some extra imported astonishment. Life, if you describe it right, ought to be astonishing enough.
And what a bold move to kill off your five protagonists within the first three or four pages.
I do bring them back in the second chapter, it has to be said. It's a kind of slightly ambiguous literary resurrection I give them. The starting point is that I have a part-time job teaching at Goldsmiths College in South London, not surprisingly. And for 12, 13 years, I've been walking to work past what's now a branch of Iceland, which has got a little plaque on it saying here in November 1944, 168 people were killed when a V2 fell on the branch of Woolworths that used to stand here. I mean, that's awful enough in itself. But the really awful thing is it was a Saturday lunchtime and it was full of mothers with young children. So among the people it killed were a whole lot of under fives who consequently never got to see the rest of the 20th century. And I've been haunted by that. And I wanted to write something which showed quite what they'd lost and also made use of the generous powers of fiction to bring things back and to show what might have been. I should say it's not about those literal dead children. I invented a whole semi-fictional South London borough for it to happen in because those were real people. They've still got living relatives and I don't want to mess around with people's real grief, not for toying with.
And that moment where the rocket strikes, which you slow right down, we see it as if it's a slow motion film and we see how the building implodes. What kind of research did you do there as regards what happens when a bomb hits a building?
I spent more time reading about high explosives than I'd ever expected to. But then I don't enjoy reading about bodies being ripped apart, but I enjoy stuff on the whole. I used to be a nonfiction writer and I still very much enjoy and get my imagination spurred and going from the encounter with how things work. It gives me ideas. So I enjoyed finding out about what exactly happens in each 10,000th of a second as 910 kilos of German explosive go off. When you've got an event which really is about a 10,000th of a second long and yet its effects last for decades and decades and decades in terms of, you know, the lives that the victims miss, you've got to find a way, if you can, to write about time on this tiny, tiny scale and then put it next to time on the human scale that we're used to because they are connected and they're both real. So the book is partly an experiment in how to talk about very, very fast things and how to talk about the patterns that lives make when you're 40 and 50 and 60 and 70, as well as 10 and 20. The long run and the very, very short run joined together.
And it allowed you to experiment as a writer, given that space. So there's one chapter that's almost all in dialogue, for example, and another chapter that's chunks of fragile and fragmentary thought.
I had five very different, what sociologists would call life worlds going. I mean, five people for whom the experience of being them on the inside of their head was radically contrasting. So there's Joe, whose head is filled with music all the time and who sees music in colours. There's Val, her twin, with her fatal attraction to bad boys, who lands an extraordinarily bad boy in a seriously evil sense and ends up being complicit in something horrible and then has to work her way painfully, painfully back. There's poor Ben, who is mentally ill and whose head is alternately a kind of bowl of extraordinary light and a bowl of extraordinary tormented darkness. There's Alec, who is literally a smart Alec, who is the printer and later a teacher, who works and takes responsibility and tries to understand and has a kind of outward focused, outgoing life. And then there's Vern, who really, really wants to get rich, but is slightly sabotaged by his own kind of internal mental compartment where he keeps his love for opera. He spends most of his life ignoring the things that operas are about in order to get rich, comfort eating when he's feeling unhappy and doesn't want to think about why. And I move onwards through the 20th century, and each time I come to them, I get a chapter about each of them, and they always contrasted wildly, and it seemed right that they should have different forms to go with the different feel of being them. So with poor Ben, the chapters about him are very inside his head, almost trapped inside his head. With others, they're much more outgoing or they're focused on music. You can't render a city. City's too big to write about, really. You can only ever pick a few people out of a city, but you can give a kind of little microcosm of just how much different human life is at work, living right next door to each other, you know, in a city, by picking a few people who are different enough and then artfully putting, well, I hope artfully, putting the differences next to each other so that you get a sense of just how different human beings are from each other and how they are still capable of communicating.
Those differences, particularly in the 80s, in the Thatcherite era, they are really stretched out and really emphasise race and politics. Workers' rights are a theme that keep coming back, keep running through the book. I mean, how political is this book? How much of your politics did you put in it?
I tried to... My working understanding of what a novelist is somebody who manages to be sympathetic to absolutely everybody in a book. Not that, you know, you don't make judgments about them, but that your sympathies are bigger and wider and more generous and more patient than your own actual opinions. So I tried to, of course my politics are in there, but I tried to hold them back and allow room for things that very much weren't my politics to have space to grow as well. Having said that, if you're telling yourself a story of London and how it's changed, one of the things you notice is that you start off with this place of austerity and ruins and black and white Pathé newsreels and piles of rubble, and then you get social deference melting away and the things working class kids could do becoming much richer and more various. And then a whole lot of people arriving in London from the war onwards who changed the nature of the city in a way that the white inhabitants didn't always find very comfortable. In fact, some of their reactions to it were deeply toxic. And there is a point of maximum, I don't know if this is a defensible remark historically, but it struck me, having lived through the 1970s, late 70s, early 80s in London, there was a point of maximum tension and pressure there where you could feel that the old sense of what London's city was having to give way, having to bend in order not to break, in order to actually to improve considerably. London by the 1990s was a much more optimistic place than it had been in the 70s and early 80s. I mean, now history doesn't end, it goes on and on and on. London has many more changes ahead of it. But it has an identity now as a kind of rather glorious world city full of terrible deprivations and sufferings as well as glitter, but also with what strikes me as a great ability to hold many, many different kinds of lives and hearts and souls and things alongside each other. And my book is partly about the birth of that, although my characters aren't necessarily looking in that direction, but it's going on in the background.
Thank you, Francis. We'll come back to you in just a moment, but we'll stay in the 1980s for a little while longer. Scarred for Life, Volume 2, Television in the 1980s, takes a look at some of the landmark and most memorable TV programmes of the decade, from The Edge of Darkness to The Singing Detective to Grange Hill. The book opens with quotes from Mary Whitehouse and Chris Tarrant, the then presenter of Tiswas. And I put it to the authors Dave Lawrence and Stephen Brotherston that the 80s were a pretty morally divided decade.
Absolutely, that's a weird thing, because for Scarred for Life Volume 1, it was originally a very different book. It wasn't just incredibly dark stuff. I wrote a massive article about Blue Peter versus Magpie, Swap Shop versus Tiswas, that kind of, when you were a kid, you were in different camps and it was very class structured, because Mary Whitehouse loomed large. She had so much power in the 1980s that dwindled away in the 1990s. And there was that thing of what I say goes, I am the moral guardian of the country. And there's Chris Tarrant going, well, this is what they want. The lingering memory of the 1980s is neon grids, Testarossa cars, shoulder pads and big hair. And the reality for us was grey skies, the threat of nuclear war, AIDS, heroin. There was a very gloomy, downbeat air.
And looking over the chapter titles of your book, the names of all these TV shows, which was just so lovely to read again. Are there any characteristics of shows during that age? Or is it really varied? Is it Dennis Potter kind of things through to Dynasty? Or is there something that you can pin on it that says that's a 1980s TV show?
There's definitely thematic similarities between different shows. I mean, at the moment, I'm currently on a rewatch of Grange Hill from the 80s. And you notice in there, they're addressing unemployment and racism and stuff like that. And you're getting that across the board. Even in comedy dramas like Minder and one called Prospects, again, unemployment is looming large.
And nuclear war as well. Nuclear war seeped into everything. Only Fools and Horses, The Young Ones, Threads, unemployment and nuclear war seem to seep into everything.
And you've chosen to also look at public information films as well from that period. Why did you do that?
It was a huge chunk of our childhoods. You'd be watching children's television sort of 4:30 in the afternoon. It would cut to an advert. They'd show three adverts and suddenly they'd show like Lonely Water or the one where the boy goes to retrieve his frisbee. And it was like kids getting killed, kids getting maimed, traffic accidents. It would hit you without warning. If you grew up as a child or a teenager in the 70s and 80s, you will remember some of those public information films vividly, and they will trigger some horrific memories for you.
We did get people saying to us they were afraid of escalators because of an escalator public information film where they Welly gets chewed up in the side of the escalator.
As a 50-year-old manly, there's a rabies public information film from the 70s that I still cannot watch because I tried to watch it to write about it in Volume 2. And I had to hand it over to Dave because it terrified me so much as a child. I can't go back. It genuinely scarred me for life.
It's a very scary 48 seconds.
Let's talk about something nice. Let's talk about the things that you were able to write about. So the headings of chapters are the names of TV shows. Just run through a few of the headings for me and tell me the kinds of things that you were looking at for people who haven't read the book.
Well, we've got children's television because that was a huge, huge part of obviously growing up. It goes from the really obscure shows such as Noah's Castle to things like The Moomins. Chucky was a huge one.
Victoriana type things. You got like Ghost in the Water, stuff like that, you know, Moondial. There were a lot of ghost programs in the 80s as well.
Yeah, science fiction, Blake 7, yeah. Which is incredibly dark. V, the American miniseries V. There was a spate of writer and director led surreal dramas. We cover those.
Going back to Dennis Potter, The Singing Detective, we look at Brimstone and Treacle because that finally got shown in the 1980s after being banned.
It's a section called How We Used to Live, which kind of reflects society of the time through the television. I think we cover pretty much every single nook and cranny of television through the 1980s. Newsflashes, Dave wrote a piece on Newsflashes.
Yes, I did Newsflashes, yeah, because there was nothing that chilled us to the bone more than the Newsflash in the 1980s. There'd just be a stark graphic of the word Newsflash. You'd say, okay, is Trevor McDonald going to come on now and tell us we're about at war? Sometimes it'd be terrible, it'd be Chernobyl, it'd be Challenger, sometimes it'd be World Birth, or it'd be... One of them was on Richard Branson crashing his balloon in Ireland on his transatlantic balloon flight. They chilled us to the bone because everything stopped for that news item. Obviously, because of your fears of what was going on in the world, you'd think, OK, this is it now. This is the nuclear war that I've been expecting.
And you reminded me of the way that we used to watch television. So no remote control. colour TV for some households was only a recent thing. The screen size was very small, only four channels, finished broadcasting around about midnight and didn't start till sometimes mid-morning. I mean, my goodness, how things have changed. That's before we even get into things like videotape recorders and all of that.
We didn't get our video recorder till 1986 when I was 16. I think people used to concentrate more on television because it may be your one and only chance to watch this programme. Whereas nowadays, people live tweet through TV shows, or you kind of have your phone and idly glance at it. As you said, there was four channels, so you're pretty certain there was a one in four chance that one of your mates had seen the same thing that you'd seen. Whereas now, with streaming and hundreds of channels, you kind of, it's so fragmented. There's not as much of a communal experience.
And there was some great drama there, wasn't there? I mean, we've mentioned Dennis Potter, other people like Alan Bleasdale. Episodes of Brookside were often like mini dramas in themselves.
We talk about this crazy director called Michael J. Burless. You probably remember quite a lot of his dramas were set in like the Greek islands and stuff like that. He wrote stuff like Maelstrom and Dark Side of the Sun, which is insane. It's about a devil impregnating a woman by impersonating her dead husband. It's just very strange things. But I think people were given far more leeway to make the things they wanted to make. I think there's far more, here's the money, go do your thing and we'll just show it. I think nowadays, getting back to the differences in TV, there's more control of what you see in a sense. You can turn the TV on and get anything. I think now it's going to be like the Antiques Roadshow. It's going to be within a certain narrow parameters. But I think in those days, it was just a free-for-all with creativity.
And if I had to pin you down, both of you, to what your favourite TV show was of the 1980s, what would it be?
Grange Hill. During the 1980s, Grange Hill went through its absolute golden period, the one that everyone remembers with the classic characters. There was a famous storyline. One of the most popular characters called Zamo developed a heroin addiction. During a huge heroin hysteria. So you followed him over two series, developing his habit, and then this next series was kicking the habit. The big storyline for me, which I still think is some of the best writing on British television, was one of the school bullies, Gripper Stebson, over the course of one series, went full racist. He went full National Front, and it was just this incredible exploration of racism. It taught children so much about society, about right and wrong.
The one that affected me most profoundly in the 1980s was the last episode of Blake 7. That was my favourite because I love that show. I think it's a great show. But yeah, the last episode, I'm not going to say what happens, but it ruined Christmas.
So the television landscape, very, very different these days. And we were talking about Mary Whitehouse at the beginning. And we look now, we can stream things like Bridgerton into our homes and nobody says a thing. 63 million people do that. We have TV throughout the day, millions of channels, 24-hour news. But presumably we needed the 80s. To get to where we are now.
Yeah, I think the 80s was the start of people wanting to be able to access stuff again. I think, you know, because obviously a lot of, if you think about like Doctor Who's, your Blake Sevens, things like that, people wanted more material from it. So when Doctor Who went off the air, for example, in 1989, people kept creating stuff. So I think people became aware that people wanted access to things that they couldn't previously have. And also with VHS arriving, you've got people, the BBC suddenly think, hang on a minute, there's a market for this thing. With the changing world with the internet as well, people want access stuff at their convenience now. There's no traditional structure to TV watching anymore. The level of technology, I think, has driven the access to TV in the way it is now.
That's really interesting, Dave, because I see on Twitter, I've not watched it myself, but it's all anyone's talking about on Twitter at the moment is WandaVision, the Marvel show. And people in America especially are going, why do we have to wait a week between episodes? It's killing me. Obviously, our generation are going, that's what you do. That's how it's supposed to be. And I think there's a backlash against that binge watching. We're going to drop all 10 episodes on one day because you watch an episode, you digest it properly, and then you can talk to people about it and anticipate the next episode. And I've never lost that love of watching one or two episodes at a time and soaking it in and thinking about it. And I think it's going back to the old ways.
And do you think there's something as well about how the media are reacting to TV? I mean, I remember when Dallas and Who Shot JR, and one of the papers got hold of Who Shot JR because the episode had been broadcast in America before the UK, and they splashed it all over their newspapers. But now people must have known who won The Masked Singer. People must have known who won Bake Off. And yet the media keeps quiet on that because they know that viewers want that tension. They don't want it to be spoiled anymore.
There's definitely a community of viewing now that doesn't want to be spoiled, I think. Plus, I think traditional newspaper print media is probably dying a bit now. The readership isn't as great. So you've not got that reach anymore to ruin everybody's day with your spoilers. Yeah, I think people try and keep away from things a little bit now as well. I don't know who won The Masked Singer, by the way. I don't know anything about that. Sorry.
What are you doing with your life?
Not watching the
watching old TV shows.
Watching Blake 7, yeah.
Yeah, watching old ropey 80s TV shows. That's what I'm doing. I think people are very anti-spoilers now, I think. And maybe that's something to do with the fact that moving back to one episode a week, the people want definitely. To be able to enjoy that build-up to the next episode rather than somebody say, yeah, it was him who did it. They don't want to be spoiled.
And you can buy Scarred for Life Volume 2, Television in the 1980s, from lulu.com. We're speaking on Bookmark today to our featured guest, Francis Spufford, about his novel, Light Perpetual. Francis, as we've said, the novel covers the lives not lived of the characters who are killed very early on in the book. So in the reader, you are constantly reading this with this air of joy, sadness, poignancy, the feelings when you were writing this, as well as following the individual stories of the characters, you must be aware of the effect that that was having on the readers, this joy and anger and grief that was going unlived.
I suppose two things at the same time. First of all, I wanted in the middle of the book for it to be possible to forget to some extent that this is all about dead people. These are all lives not lived. I wanted them to seem solider in the middle, in the way that in the middle of any life, when death and the space when you weren't before your life is furthest away, you don't think about that stuff. And then it comes through at moments and then it comes back again as you get older, if you're lucky. But as well as that, yeah, I wanted it to be a book full of feeling, but you can't control how what you're feeling is going to affect other readers. You put it out there generously. You do things which you think will work, but it's a collaboration with this silent partner. On the other side of the table, as you write, not quite imaginable, is your eventual reader who's going to do half the job of deciding whether the funny things are funny and the moving things are moving. You're playing to this invisible partner. So I'm very glad if it moves people, but I don't expect it will move people in quite the way it moved me when I was writing it. But somewhere in between there is a book, with any luck.
Now, how did it move you when you were writing it?
I'm an extremely tearful person. I embarrass my daughter by my capacity to burst into tears in cinemas or any old thing. So I'm just a big softie. I'm also somebody now in their late 50s who has that sense you get this point in life of being able to see much more life behind you than ahead of you, and some sense of the whole arc or shape of a life, and the kind of, there's a particular way in which life is touching because it passes. There's a sense of transience and of life being precious because the moments are a finite supply of moments, and they pass and will be gone. I don't think that's quite the whole story. I'm a religious person, but whether or not you believe that there's eternity as well as time, you could be pretty clear that we get a finite amount of time, and that there are those moments when, as in the Sandy Denny song, you think, who knows where the time goes? And there are moments where you're just struck through that things that were precious to you are now irretrievably in the past. People you've loved, places you've known, they pass away, and we do our singing in temporary homes with a temporary foothold on the planet. That's how it works. And once you're not young anymore, you notice that and it goes through you.
And this isn't a religious book that you have written about your faith in the past. The religion is in it and characters experience religion, but the fact that this is life after death does suggest something, and the title itself as well.
Yeah, I mean, the title comes from the prayer for the dead. May light perpetual shine upon them. But light comes up in the book in all varieties, starting with the extremely ominous light of the explosion that kills the cast. And I wanted it to be, not ironic, but open to all of the different things that light is in a life, from the fully glorious to the sinister and the troubling in between. And the other part, perpetual. Things don't last literally forever for human beings. We're temporary. So when we long for light perpetual, we may have got something profound and true in our sights, but it's a hope that we set against the certain knowledge of being mortal.
Well, let's hear some music now. Let's change gear a little bit. I love this track. It's so lovely to hear this again. This is Sade and When Am I Going to Make a Living? Why this one?
because it's such 1980s music. This is one of the times that I was living in London. It's also one of the points at which the different kinds of music that London's making starts to come together. Dusty Springfield is a white English woman singing music remotely but strongly influenced by kind of African-American music. And now you've got Sade in the 1980s and the different strands of music in Britain are starting to come together. And you get something which sounds like this.
Cambridge 105 Radio. Kickstart your weekend.
Saturday Breakfast with Matt Webb.
I'm here every weekend to get you moving. I've the latest from the Cambridge News Desk on the hour and half hour. Problems on the A14, Newmarket Road or Mill Road? Well, if there are, you'll be the first to know in the travel. There's a full sports roundup at 8:30, including what's happening at Cambridge United and our other local clubs. Plus a look at the Saturday papers and local online publications at 10 to 9. That's Saturday Breakfast with me, Matt Webb, this weekend from 8.
If you're like me, you've got a family and a business, and you want to protect what's most important when the chips are down. With Woodfine Solicitors, that's exactly what happens. I got a bespoke legal service from a friendly, expert team. They really listened to what was going on and tailored their recommendations to my situation, which was, well, that's another story. Anyway, the best thing was that it all happened online. A few simple clicks and I had my quote. That freed up time to focus on everything else. Get the help you need when you need it most. Visit woodfines.co.uk or call Cambridge 411 421. Woodfines, cutting through the red tape.
What does your home need to feel complete? Gap Home Improvements have been helping customers give their properties that curb appeal for over 20 years. You've seen our vans in your area providing dedicated support to families across Cambridgeshire. Windows, doors, garden rooms, conservatories and warm roofs. We offer free quotations in a pressure-free environment. In person, on the phone or by video call, our consultants will help you realise your property's true potential. Call Cambridge 914 567 or visit gaphomeimprovements.co.uk today.
Cambridge 105 Radio. Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than boasts.
And our featured guest on Bookmark today is Francis Spufford, talking about his novel Light Perpetual. Francis, we've talked about the recurring themes in the novel. We've talked about race and politics. Another one that comes up is mental illness and changing attitudes to mental illness. And you contrast the way that people would throw drugs at it in the past to now a much more thoughtful approach and a more open approach in terms of talking about it. It is a theme that is there in almost every one of the visits that we make to your characters.
I hope things have got better. I do show poor Ben being stuck early on in his life in a kind of old...
I love Ben. He's my favourite character.
I love Ben too, though of course they're all my favourites because you can't have favouritism among your imaginary children. Even Vern, the 22 stone property developer who never met a person he didn't try to rip off. I love you too, Vern. Anyway, Ben gets sent to basically a Victorian asylum and filled up with Largactyl stroke Thorazine, which is a kind of chemical cosh. The awful thing is that he kind of welcomes it because his relationship with his own thoughts is so tormented that he kind of likes something that freezes him in his tracks. And then once they take him off it and discharge him, he's on his own and he never tells anyone what's going on inside his head. He self-medicates with street drugs. He copes until he breaks down and tells somebody about it who, luckily for him, is a person worth loving and some combination of improved mental health care and better drugs, because he's still on an improved 1990s drug, and the love of a good person and possibly working really, really hard because it's a highly industrious person he's fallen for, and a bit of Pentecostal religion, and who knows, possibly getting exorcised as well. He can't tell which of the things made him happy, but something did. Means that he ends up somewhere where And his capacity for happiness is about as intense as his capacity for misery. So, but I hope that it's worth bearing with his extended trip to hell, because he gets to go to somewhere fairly heavenly eventually.
How difficult was it to resist the characters interconnecting? They do occasionally cross paths, but they don't interconnect in a big way. And I like that, just because it's not EastEnders, is it? Just because you all live in one area of London doesn't mean you're going to marry each other.
That's exactly it. I didn't want to write a soap. People, particularly in big cities, do not form neatly arranged little plots in which everybody is in and out of each other's business. You live near somebody and your lives can run alongside them and scarcely ever touch. Joe and Val are sisters, and that's why they know each other all their lives. Otherwise, every now and again, they cross paths, and that's about it. That was part of not this time wanting the artifices of plot. I wanted to see if you could get a story which was a good enough and real enough story without elaborately knotting the different lives together, without making one thing depend on the other thing. I wanted it just to flow on the way that lives do, and to be interesting the way that lives are.
And on a practical level, how did you write it? Did you switch from character to character? And how did you get in the head of each of those characters? Because they're very different heads.
I am the kind of writer who has to feel that what's behind them in a book is completely done. Otherwise, they can't go on. So I wrote it in exactly the order it ends up in. You know, it moves on in 15-year jumps. So I'd arrive in 1964, and then I'd write one person's chapter, and then another person's chapter, and then another person's chapter, until I had five chapters, and then I'd move on another 15 years and do it again. So I never got to follow any of the strands continuously. I kept having to change, but then they needed to go next to each other in the book, and the reader was going to have to jump people as well. And I thought that it would be better for me to keep my eye on what it was going to be like for the reader so far as I could. Also, it was kind of intense being in each of their heads, and I was ready for a change by the time I'd done one day inside each of them, because they all get a day in each of the time periods. Some were easier than others. There is a particular point of horror in Val's story in 1979, which I knew was coming up. It was looming like a kind of black mass on the horizon. I was not looking forward to getting to it, and it was indeed singularly horrible to write. But on the whole, I've got to know them quite well by the time I'd reached the middle of the book. I could still be gently surprised by how they'd changed. Each one of them was a refreshment from the previous one. So I mostly enjoyed being them very much. And I liked the fiddly technical bits of trying to convey what had happened to them in between without just going into a load of dull, inert backstory.
Thank you, Francis. Well, let's stay in the head now, because we're talking psychological thrillers with Geetha Lodge. Geetha's debut novel, She Lies in Wait, published in 2019, became a Sunday Times bestseller and a Richard and Judy Book Club pick. Her second novel, Watching from the Dark, came out last year, and her third, Lie Beside Me, was published in February. When I spoke to Geetha, I asked her to tell me what it's about.
So Lie Beside Me is about Louise Reeks, mostly, who is a young woman who wakes up after a really big night out with no memory of really anything, particularly not how she got home. She rolls over to cuddle her husband and then finds that the man lying next to her is not only a complete stranger, but is also dead, and he has not died prettily. So then the real impetus of the book is split between her trying to find out what happened and to work out whether she's done something terrible, and the police trying to uncover the truth as well, and the two almost fighting with each other because, of course, like most people, she tries to hide what's happened quite ferociously, particularly from her husband.
And this is in the same mould as your previous novel, She Lies in Wait, and Watching from the Dark, a kind of crime psychological thriller. Is that your genre now then?
Yeah, I think that's my comfortable genre. And because I'm writing in this series at the moment with Jonah Sheens and his team, the detectives stay the same and they have their own stories that run in the background. What interests me as well about the series is as much them and how they develop as it is about the big cases. So each one has to be something which appeals to me and which has a hook, because that's really important to me. I know, as a reader and as a writer as well, but also having a team who we hopefully grow to care about. And I think that's really important in injecting a little added element of warmth and heart to a crime story anyway.
And is Jonah progressing the way you thought she would? Is his life going in the direction that you'd planned?
So certainly at the moment it is. There are maybe some twists coming up which are a little bit different. which has sort of occurred to me a little bit later. But certainly in terms of what I'd originally planned for him, it's very much running that way. So you'll see in book three, his sort of personal life develops a chunk. But we also see a lot from Juliet Hanson, who is the youngest member of the team, the constable. So she just became a constable when She Lies in Wait started. She's learnt a lot since, but she's also got a lot of her own baggage. She's got an ex-partner who is still, unfortunately, rather a feature of her life. She's got these rather complex relationships with the rest of the team. And in Lie Beside Me, we get a little bit more room for her to have her story.
And what is it about the psychological thriller? Why does that appeal to you? What is it about it?
I love seeing people in really strange and stressful circumstances, particularly ordinary people, and then working out how they react, about, you know, what happens to people in really strange and trying times. And I think that so much of the real thrill in reading for me is about having a sort of real sense of mystery and wonder and, oh my goodness, how's that going to resolve itself? And psychological thriller just does that so well, I think. Well, when it's really done well. And I really, really enjoyed kind of getting more in Lie Beside Me into that element, because I think it's more psych thriller than the previous two books have been, in fact, where you see a lot of it from the perspective of someone who's really thrown into the middle of things. So for Louise, I mean, really, that is a pretty horrible awakening to happen to anyone. And her frantic flailing to work out what to do next is, I think, part of the draw.
And what makes a good psychological thriller, then? You say when it's done well, what makes it good?
A lot of it is about character. I think if you can really sympathise and empathise with the main character, that makes for a really good story, inevitably. And there's nothing new in saying that, I'm sure, but I do think that for psych thriller, it's particularly important. If we don't really care about what happens to them, then the suspense, I think, is just lost. But I also think it's about the really careful parceling out of information and how much your viewpoint changes and twists. And if it's done carefully enough, I feel that the reader should get there maybe just before the police at every point, and should really feel the sort of almost visceral impact of a twist or a revelation, and feel that that's incredibly satisfying.
And as a writer, how do you do that? How do you go about the pacing? Do you map it out and say, I'm going to have a big reveal here, a peak here? Is it on post-it notes around your room?
So I really do map it. I tend to get what is essentially only a couple of A4 sheets and just do the kind of the key points and the key turning points in the book. And I'll say to myself, 25% in this basic thing happens, these couple of changes, 50% in this happens. But then the interesting thing is it changes hugely when writing it, because actually, as soon as you then write some scenes out, you're much more in the mindset of the reader. You're feeling it as they feel it. I find that certainly. So what then happens is I realise it's not satisfying to have the reveal just here. It needs to be there, or something needs to change at this point to keep them feeling really interested and really hooked into the story. Or a huge element that I hadn't ever thought of in the plan will occur to me, because now I've got my characters together, I can see where it'll go. So there's lots of change that then happens. And I think that real awareness of how it's going to be for the reader and how their experiences at any point in the book is the key to that.
And what about outside politics? I'm thinking of things like the Me Too movement. And we're talking today, there's talk of Reclaim the Streets marches following the murder of another woman. Where do psychological thrillers sit in that? Because a lot of the time they are about putting people in jeopardy or putting people in positions of powerlessness. How do you as a writer accommodate all that without being exploitative?
It's a really interesting one, and I've put a lot of thought into it, particularly given that in the first two books that I wrote, the victim was a female. And I wanted to give a lot of thought to that and make it not just something that was automatic and not gratuitous. So for me, the way of making sure that we think about it seriously and it's not just something that's normalised is to give those victims a real voice, to make them real living, breathing characters. And it's so important to me that when I present someone having been killed in a book, that it's not simply a puzzle to be solved. This is what life is for some people. Their life ends in horrific murder, or families of those people, their lives become irrevocably changed and tainted by it. And I really want to make sure that in every case, it's really something that's felt by the reader, that it's never just dashed off. And that's why, for me, I never get to the point in a book where I think, oh, it needs some more tension. Oh, let's just throw in a body. I've never done that. And I don't think I ever will be capable of doing that, because it means too much to me that every person has meaning, has life, has soul, has character.
You have role models in this genre who you follow and look up to?
Certainly do. I think there are a lot of very strong writers in recent years. I think one of the real formative writers for me, well, there were two actually who are both from the sort of Scottish noir, Val McDermid and Ian Rankin, because they really write in a way that makes you feel. There's never a victim who is just forgotten. And there's some people who maybe you think to a certain extent might deserve something bad happening to them, but not death. You know, it's never just, oh, well, that's okay because they're a bad guy. And I think having moved on to them, probably at far too young age, about 11 or 12, from having read Agatha Christie, where it's all very cozy crime and the puzzle, and even Dorothy Sayers, who's a bit more in the direction of making you care. Those guys were real eye-openers for me. But there are so many other really great writers around at the moment who can make you feel. I think Chris Whitaker does an amazing job of it. Gillian McAllister really makes me care so much for her characters because they're so three-dimensional and they have all these marvellous quirks. I really think those guys are just the best.
It's a very dark world you're inhabiting when you're writing. What do you do to lighten up?
Oh, well, I mean, one thing that I do even in the writing is to try and keep the kind of human interaction element going with my team. I say my team, I mean the detective team. So making sure that there is banter, you know, that there is a chance for them to be themselves. There is humour because inevitably, even in terrible circumstances, there can be very strange humour to be found. And I think that's really important. In terms of lightening up the rest of the time, I can easily just go and talk to my 10-year-old because he is outrageously rude to me in a very funny way. And that's immediately a great, great alternative to all this hard-hitting drama that I'm writing at the time.
And what's next for you then?
So I'm just putting the finishing touches to the fourth book in the Jonah Sheen series. So I'm very luckily contracted for books 4 and 5 and hopefully onwards. Certainly I've got plans up to about book 8. So if they don't let me do them, I'll be very sad. I'm quite keen to do a standalone at some point as well. So that's something I'll sort of work in. I had this immensely optimistic thought that I might have time to do one this year until obviously lockdown happened and I spent a lot more time with the 10-year-old. And I also foolishly decided to move house, which didn't make for the most productive summer.
And Lie Beside Me by Geetha Lodge is published by Penguin. We've been talking today on Bookmark to Francis Spufford about his novel Light Perpetual, published by Faber. Francis, how did it feel to let them go, these characters whose lives you'd followed from death to death, really? Must have been sad to say goodbye.
It was extremely sad to say goodbye. I felt very mournful, as if 5 people I knew had indeed all I'd received news of their deaths. I'm not quite as tearful as Charles Dickens was when he was writing. He would burst into tears regularly at the deaths of characters, and his children could hear him in his writing room wailing. And once they hammered on the door and said, "Papa, Papa, you're all right?" And he went, "Joe the Crossing Sweeper is dead." I didn't quite do that, particularly not since I was writing in cafes and people look at you if you suddenly start sobbing into your cappuccino. But no, if you take them seriously enough to behave as if they're really living, then you can't take it back when they're really dying.
Well, it is a wonderful novel. I highly recommend it. What is next for you? What are you working on at the moment?
Something completely different.
Again?
Yeah, again. Well, I've always had enough of the thing that I've been concentrating on hard for several years. So I'm now trying to write a kind of noirish crime novel set in a city that never existed on the banks of the Mississippi in 1922 with Jesuits and a jazz soundtrack.
I look forward to talking to you about that. That sounds fantastic. And a question we ask all our guests on Bookmark is, what are you reading at the moment?
I have just finished rereading Patricia Lockwood's Priest Daddy, possibly the funniest and most outrageous memoir ever. I have just bounced off George Eliot's The Mill on the Floss. I love Middlemarch. I always think I want to read The Mill on the Floss. It always makes me miserable, and then I give up, and I have. a James Ellroy novel, but that's mainly research, because I'm not sure I'm enjoying it. But yeah.
Nicely eclectic. I would expect nothing less from you. We'll come back to you in just a moment for your last choice of music, but a heads up that our next show, our featured guest is Geoffrey Archer, talking about his new novel, Turn a Blind Eye. We'll also hear from Mick Finlay and Sid Moore, talking about using real life to write crime fiction, and Helen Scales will be chatting about her book about the deep sea called The Brilliant Abyss. But we'll sign out now, Francis, with your last choice of music, which is Second Chances by Gregory Alan Isaacoff. Why this one?
Well, this one has got nothing to do with London, but it's on the button for the theme of the novel, which is about the redemptive possibilities that come along after you've screwed up. I really like this kind of folky Americana.
All my heroes stood up straight.